Welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Monday, November 28th. I'm your reader, Kelly Neff. Let's begin today, like we begin every other day, by taking a look at the weather. For today, partly sunny, a southerly wind at 10 to 20 miles per hour, a high of 46 and a low of 32. Tomorrow, there is a chance of rain or snow, with a southerly wind at 15 to 25 miles per hour, a high of 49 and a low of 24. On Wednesday, there's a chance of some snow, with a westerly wind at 20 to 30 miles per hour plus, a high of 31 and a low of 16. Then on Thursday, partly sunny with a northwesterly wind at 10 to 20 miles per hour. Expect a high of 34 and a low of 25. Taking a look at today's top weather story, it comes from meteorologist Corey Thompson, who says, expect some variation in weather over the next 7 to 10 days as our weather pattern becomes a bit more active. The first patch of active weather arrives on Tuesday and into Wednesday. A storm system should develop on the plains and move right over the state, giving us a shot at some rain or a rain-snow mix. The most likely area to see accumulation is to our northwest, especially toward north-central Iowa. A severe weather outbreak is possible Tuesday in Arkansas. The second storm system is at the tail end of our 9-day forecast, so it's less certain that far away. But it also will carry the risk for a round of rain or snow in the central United States, so stay tuned. And that is today's top weather story from meteorologist Corey Thompson. Our first front page story today is written by Grace King of the Gazette, and it's headlined, Solon Schools Plan $25 Million Bond. Dateline, Solon. The Solon Community School District is proposing a $25 million bond referendum in March that would fund an expansion to its intermediate school, build a multi-purpose indoor activity center, and make improvements to its facilities. The Solon Intermediate School, which serves 4th and 5th graders, was built in 2017 and designed for a wing to be added when necessary, according to Superintendent Davis Idol. The wing would provide room for 3rd graders to move from Lakeview Elementary to the intermediate building. This would create enough space in the district's schools to accommodate 7 classrooms per grade level in pre-kindergarten through 8th grade. That's according to Solon Intermediate Principal Melissa Holtz. The addition to Solon Intermediate is estimated to cost between $9 and $10 million, which includes 7 general education classrooms, 1 special education classroom, 1 project-based learning room, and a gym. Another major proposal under the bond is building a multi-purpose indoor activity facility with turf flooring that could be used for baseball, softball, soccer, golf, marching band, archery, and other activities. The middle school property would be a potential site for the $4 million project. Solon Activities Director Casey Hack said, "It's really exciting to think of the possibility of giving our students a space suited for what they're doing." The bond referendum could be taken to voters as early as March 7th and would not increase property taxes, according to Idol. The district's current tax rate of $16.28 per $1,000 of taxable valuation would be unchanged if voters approved the bond. The district, like the town of Solon, has seen a steady increase in enrollment since 2014 and anticipates planned housing developments with another 500 new residential units to bring additional families to the district. Solon School's current enrollment is 1,450 and is expected to increase by about 350 to 750 over the next 10 years, depending on how quickly new housing development takes shape. The plan includes updating Lakeview Elementary School, which was built in 1966, and the district administrative offices with major building systems, including electrical, plumbing, heating, and ventilation. Other projects at Lakeview Elementary would include updating the gym floor and replacing the bleachers, adding energy-efficient lighting, repainting classrooms, renovating the library for group collaboration, and replacing worn playground equipment. This project could cost up to $7 million. Currently, according to district officials, the district's administrative office is located in the 1917-built tower of the former middle and high school. The building has excess space, which the school district does not need, and the majority of the building is leased to the city. The city has indicated it may eventually end its lease, which leaves the district with a significant amount of unneeded space. Idol said a recent facility assessment identified more than $4 million in repairs needed, making the space unusable for a school. Even if improvements can be made, the building would not meet educational standards of today. One option is to update and maintain only the 1917 tower portion of the school and demolish the rest of the building, which would be a $5 million project, and is not recommended by district officials as it is not, quote, financially responsible. Another option is to demolish the entire building and replace it with a 4,000-square-foot office building for $2.1 million. The site would be cleared and maintained for a potential new school should it be needed in the future. Idol said that the bond would also include renovating a former truck stop purchased by the district on the north edge of town into a transportation venter with a covered space for bus parking for $650,000. This would help extend the life of district-owned buses and reduce the amount of time drivers spend prepping buses in the winter months. Finally, the bond would provide funds to replace the 12-year-old turf field at Spartan Stadium for $800,000. The district has experienced cost benefit from not having to water or mow the field for the last 12 years, according to school officials. Here's a front page story written by Marissa Payne of the Gazette. Goats could graze way to maintaining CR parks. Dateline, Cedar Rapids. Goats may be let loose to graze in city parks in a pilot project next year as Cedar Rapids explores policy changes that would allow controlled livestock grazing to help manage primarily unmaintained areas of parks. Parks and Recreation Director Hashim Taylor said a team is working on ways the city could possibly do a pilot program to allow goat grazing to clear unwieldy brush. The ideal location would be Bever Park, most likely in summer of 2023, he said. The Bever Park Neighborhood Association issued a request for goat grazing there. Cedar Rapids ordinances do not currently allow electric fences in parks, so that is among the policies officials are examining. City code also does not permit unleashed animals within municipal parks unless the area is designated as an off-leash space and a dog displays a permit tag within the area's boundaries. Taylor said he was really excited about it as a possibility. Use of the goats would require low-voltage electric fences. There would be an effort to add signage and communicate with the public about the fences, but staff said the electric current would feel like a tickle for any human who might touch it. Secondary fencing also would be preferred. Depending on how the possible program takes shape, Taylor recently joked with the Parks, Waterways, and Recreation Commission, saying there's a possibility we'll have a goat division. Parks Superintendent Mish Aronson said after Cedar Rapids lost about two-thirds of its tree canopy in the August 2020 derecho, the city is seeing an uptick in invasive species, including in areas where the city would like to replant. On the possible use of goats, Andreessen said it'd be a control measure to help these other trees we're trying to establish. Andreessen said that the goats would be used in no mow or natural areas that staff can't typically access to otherwise maintain. Brendan Paul, the president of the Bever Park Neighborhood Association, said the group is interested in replanting in the forested area of Bever Park to reestablish the ecosystem. But first, he said, the group hopes to use goats to tackle the invasive species that have grown since the devastating storm and been given a chance to take hold thanks to the sunlight that streams in because of tree canopy loss. Paul said, getting these goats back there and mowing everything down and kind of restarting, rebooting it, and then giving trees a chance to get out is the goal. Would love to test that. Plus, Paul said, the goats come with a novelty factor that draws people in to watch them on the job. Chris Thomas, who's vice chair of the city's Parks, Waterways, and Recreation Commission, supported the idea at a recent meeting by saying, "As long as this has been around as an idea, I'm happy to see you are analyzing it." The city still has to determine the parameters of the pilot program, so there is no definitive cost at this time, Taylor said. The city would contract for the goats. So far, staff have consulted with Toledo, Iowa-based Blue Collar Goatscaping to learn more about the possibility. Adam Litvina is the owner of Blue Collar Goatscaping and said his business currently has between 300 and 500 goats. About 100 goats can clear an acre a day, usually thick, brushy, or wetland areas. He used to work for the Iowa Department of Natural Resources, and that prompted the start of his business. The Iowa DNR was looking for ways to reduce the use of herbicides, cut down on expensive machinery, and avoid the dangers of using human staff to work steep angles. Some critics of the use of goats to cut down on weeds and invasive species say they don't get at the root of the plants, but Ledvina said no fix is a one-and-done solution. For instance, he said, herbicides would need to be sprayed again in another season, and there are negative environmental impacts with soil erosion and resulting water pollution. Machines also don't get at the root, but disturb the soil. Goats leave the grass that's supposed to be there, Ledvina said. Ledvina typically works with the Iowa DNR, some cities, and private landowners or conservation organizations. Smaller cities typically are able to swiftly make policy changes, Ledvina said, but a city of Cedar Rapids size has more bureaucratic hoops to jump through. Ledvina said, the issue with a lot of cities is there are ordinances, and they're always kind of trying to work around those ordinances, whether it doesn't allow livestock or doesn't allow electric net fences or electric fences in general. In recent years, his company completed a job near the General Store Pub in Stone City out in Jones County. The goats cleared an area that spurred a recreational space with trails. Most people love to watch the goats in the warmer months, Ledvina said, with some families sitting there for an hour or more to observe as the animals do their grazing work. Ledvina said, go watch the goats, and it's a pretty good time, and they're friendly, and they're just fun to watch do their thing. Moving to the Iowa Today page, here's a story, a collaboration of Gazette writers, permanent site for Boys and Girls Club advances. The Cedar Rapids City Council gave the green light last week for the Boys and Girls Clubs of the Corridor to rezone property, where the organization is building a permanent location in Cedar Rapids. The group hasn't had a standalone building since the flood of 2008 and has operated out of various locations throughout the city, including the First Congregational United Church of Christ at the corner of 17th Street and Washington Avenue Southeast in Wellington Heights. The property at 1602 Washington Avenue Southeast will be rezoned from single-family to public institutional, pending a second and possible third consideration of the ordinance to make way for the new 16,800-square-foot facility. The club estimates the new building will boost capacity to serve an additional 300 children and teens, nearly doubling the number of youth currently served by the Boys and Girls Clubs of the Corridor. Previously shared plans call for the first floor of the building to contain a gymnasium, cafeteria, game room, an education center, and a STEM lab. The second floor will have a teen center, teaching kitchen, an art room, and a music room with a DJ booth. Piasta-based Midwest Concrete Incorporated was awarded a $1.42 million contract last week to build a mini roundabout at the intersection of 12th Avenue Southeast and 2nd Street Southeast. The Cedar Rapids City Council voted to accept that bid and award the contract to Midwest Concrete among 8 bidders. The bids ranged from $1.42 million to $1.79 million. Once built, the roundabout will be similar to the ones on Johnson Avenue and Wiley Boulevard Northwest and Johnson Avenue and Jacolin Drive Northwest. Rob Davis, the City Flood Control Program Manager, has said, "The mini roundabout is more compact than a standard roundabout, but works the same for drivers. This work will be done in conjunction with work to install floodgates on the 12th Avenue Bridge, a project that is closing the bridge through much of next summer." Linn County is expected to receive about 80% of the approximately $57.6 million in disaster recovery funding awarded to the state through the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development following the August 2020 derecho. In Marion, the funds would be used to support both owner-occupied and multifamily housing projects that support low to moderate income individuals and families. City staff will contact applicants for projects to discuss that proposal. Several steps will need to be completed before the end of the year, including a public hearing, obtaining City Council approval, and submitting the application to the state. For Marion and other Linn County communities outside Cedar Rapids, applications will be submitted through the East Central Iowa Council of Governments. According to the approved action plan for the program, the breakdown of the funds within Linn County are as follows for housing. New, resilient, affordable single-family housing, $16 million. Infrastructure to support housing, $4,950,160. Owner-occupied rehabilitation, $2.5 million. And new rental housing, $15.725 million. Meanwhile, the City of Iowa City is holding a community listening post today for residents to come speak with city leaders. The listening post will be held from 5:30 to 7 o'clock tonight at Pheasant Ridge Neighborhood Center at 2651 Roberts Road. Council listening posts are an opportunity for residents to engage with council members in an informal setting. 2 council members attend a listening post and then report back to the rest of the council about what they heard from residents. Council members Pauline Taylor and John Thomas are scheduled to attend this listening post. Residents are encouraged to stop by and discuss any issue on their minds. No formal agendas or presentation is planned. Government Notes is published on Mondays and contains updates from area government bodies. Also on the Iowa Today page is a story written by Emily Anderson of the Gazette. CR man accused of sexually abusing 3 children. Dateline, Cedar Rapids. A Cedar Rapids man was arrested last Wednesday on charges that he sexually abused 3 children over a period of several years. 30-year-old Silas Paul Griffin is charged with 4 counts of second-degree sexual abuse, 2 counts of third-degree sexual abuse, and 2 counts of lascivious acts with a child, all of which are felonies. He is also charged with 2 counts of indecent contact with a child, which is an aggravated misdemeanor. Griffin abused 1 girl multiple times, according to a criminal complaint, when she was under age 12 between 2014 and 2017. He abused another when she was 12 or 13 in 2021 and abused the third when she was 10 or 11 in 2021. A warrant was issued for Griffin's arrest on this past Monday, and he was arrested this past Wednesday. He is being held in the Linn County Correctional Center awaiting his first appearance in court. Again, on the top stories page, we have an article written by Emily Anderson of the Gazette. Linn County Jail will add medical isolation cells. Dateline, Cedar Rapids. The Linn County Jail will use $1.7 million in federal pandemic relief money to fund the creation of special cells designed to mitigate the spread of infectious diseases. The money was granted to the jail by the Linn County Board of Supervisors when it approved in October a second round of federal funding from the American Rescue Plan Act. Linn County Sheriff Brian Gardner said the 12 to 14 cells will be used to prevent the spread of COVID-19 and other infections or for any other medical reason requiring an inmate to be isolated. A multi-purpose room that has been used as an indoor recreation area will be repurposed to make space for the new cells, which will house one inmate each. The overall capacity of the jail, which is currently at up to 401 inmates, won't increase with the new cells. Gardner doesn't have an estimated timeline for the changes yet. The jail still is working with architects to draw up plans. After the architectural drawings are finished, the jail will begin working on a contract for construction of the new cells. The jail had an outbreak of COVID-19 early on in the pandemic, reporting 30 cases of the virus among inmates and staff by November of 2020. At the time, the jail was screening all inmates for COVID-19 when they entered the jail and encouraging the use of masks among inmates and staff. For a while, the courts and law enforcement also issued summons instead of arresting and jailing suspects for low-level crimes. In September 2021, there was another outbreak with 18 inmates testing positive for the virus. During both of those outbreaks, entire sections of the jail were quarantined. In response to the outbreaks, the jail made a few changes, like allowing inmates into their individual cells during the day instead of requiring they be in the day area. The jail also barred visitors, but provided free letters and free phone calls to inmates instead. With the district court's permission, the jail also released several inmates to make more space for social distancing. Inmates who were released were required to reschedule when they would return to finish serving their sentences. The jail hasn't had any more major outbreaks since September of 2021, according to Gardner, and the changes that were made to reduce the spread of the virus in the jail are no longer in effect. The Linn County Sheriff's Office was one of 27 applicants to receive part of the $13 million the county had available during this round of ARPA funding. There were 72 new applicants competing for this round of funding, plus 53 eligible applicants that didn't receive funding in the first round. Most of the applicants, including the Sheriff's Office, were awarded funding under Category A of the Act, meaning the money was for affordable housing, social services, public health, capital investments, and negative economic impacts from COVID-19. Five groups received money under Category D of the Act for water and sewer infrastructure projects. The largest allocation of money from the county was for the new Westside Cedar Rapids Library, which received $4 million. The Cedar Rapids City Council gave another $6 million for the library from the city's share of ARPA funding. Let's move over to the Insight page, where today we have a story written by Amy Lago, who's been a comics and editorial cartoon editor for more than 30 years and is currently vice president of licensing and syndication with Counterpoint Media. In this guest column, Amy says, Peanuts cartoonist Charles M. Sparky Schultz would have been 100 on November 26th. That his Peanuts comic strip still is in syndication nearly 23 years after his death is testament to our affinity to the characters from When We Feel Like a Loser in Charlie Brown, the crabby Lucy Van Pelt, the philosophical Linus Van Pelt, the superfluous rerun Van Pelt, and naive Sally Brown to just wanting to have fun like Snoopy. How ironic it is, then, that the beloved 79-year-old strip debuted with the line, Good old Charlie Brown, how I hate him. The question readers ask most about Sparky is what he was like. The answer is, if you read Peanuts, you know Sparky. He was the strip. Yes, his characters often were based upon people he knew, like there was a real Charlie Brown, but within each personality was a piece of himself, even if it was a piece he didn't particularly care for, such as the title, which Sparky hated. The syndicate liked the allusions to Peanut Gallery and Kids, and to Sparky, Peanuts sounded like something of little worth. That's another irony, the strip's worth. In 2021, Sparky ranked third on Forbes' list of the world's highest-paid deceased celebrities. Besides drawing funny pictures, as he called them, Sparky was good at cultivating people, creating his own tribe. And so we come to irony number three. This man, who drew so many groups of people together, cartoonists, golfers, skaters, both hockey and figure, tennis players, celebrities, religious leaders, etc., was rather introverted. He exhibited, despite all the colleagues, friends, and family, a man could want, a loner quality. His desk and drawing table stood at the end of his studio, as far as possible from the door. His books and his stereo, though, they were directly across from him. Despite his introverted bent, Schultz was fiercely competitive. He always wanted his strip to be the best one on the page every day. He wanted to win every round of golf or hockey or tennis match. And he could turn just about anything, even social interactions, into a game, though he might make up the rules as he went along. At a cartoon festival at Ohio State University, Ask Shag cartoonist Peter Gurin and I skipped off to have lunch. I noticed his shag vanity plates. Turns out Peter mentioned this outing to Sparky. So during my next trip to see him, Sparky called Peter from his car phone and told Peter we were now sitting in his car with his Woodstock plates. I win, Sparky asserted. People also ask how you edit someone so gifted. Given Sparky's competitiveness, you don't. You make sure everything is spelled correctly. My first 5 years as a comics editor, I didn't find a single misspelling, not for lack of trying. And when you do find a mistake, you check to make sure it wasn't intentional. He even wanted to wind at being errorless. In December of 1999, after he had been diagnosed with cancer and knew it was terminal, Sparky agreed to an interview with the Today Show's Al Roker. Before Roker flew to California, United Features Syndicate's public relations executive Lily Root Bianchi and I met with Roker in his Manhattan office. I asked Roker a specific question. What would he do if, say, Sparky's nose started running during the interview and he didn't realize it? Roker responded without hesitation. He would stop taping and hand Sparky a tissue. Roker did not want to embarrass Sparky or reveal him as anything less than the brilliant, talented man he was, facing his mortality with all the dignity he could muster. After that interview, Sparky told me that he thought Peanuts reruns, which were already being distributed for the daily strips, would never work. He grew up reading newspapers as in new, so reruns made no sense to him. I responded that the syndicate had to try. A lot of people's jobs depended on it. Irony number four, he lost on his prediction, but I win. On Friday, February 11th, 2000, I picked up the phone to call Sparky. Then I put the phone down, resolving to call him on Monday instead, because it would be Valentine's Day. Then early on Sunday, February 13th, my boss called to ask if I'd heard that Sparky had died during the night. Late Saturday on the West Coast, but probably Sunday on the East Coast, the day the last original Peanut strip appeared in newspapers. Of everything there is to say about Charles M. Schultz, this might just epitomize him. In the mid to late 1990s, I found time to flip through a thick file of old Peanuts correspondence. Amid the papers was a letter from a client in Mississippi dated in the early 70s. The editor asked Sparky to stop putting Franklin in the same classroom as Peppermint Patty, implying it offended some of the paper's pro-segregation readers. He ignored it. Amy Lago has been a comics and editorial cartoon editor for more than 30 years. She's currently the Vice President of Licensing and Syndication with Counterpoint Media. And before we move on, we do have a community letter today from Carolyn L. Stucker of Springville, who says, "It's baffling to me that polls indicate that the majority of Iowans support a woman's right to choose, gun safety laws, and support for public education, yet we just elected a governor who supports none of these. We read in news reports that her first effort will be to get legislation passed that will put Iowa tax dollars to vouchers, thereby reducing funding for our public schools." She uses the word choice in her public announcements. "Most of us are aware that Iowa was once a leader in the nation. When the governor took office, we were ranked 8th, and our current ranking is now in the range of 23rd to 25th. She claims that no child should be forced into failing schools, yet has done next to nothing that would promote their improvement. Rural schools and committees will likely be hit harder. The question that I have never heard answered is whether you would sacrifice the education of so many children across the state for the benefit of the few. I have never met a teacher or a school that doesn't believe that parents matter. It's simply disingenuous to claim otherwise. Please reach out to your representatives if you want to know where they stand on the issue." And that is from Carolyn L. Stucker of Springville. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Monday, November 28th. On IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Today we start out with the shorter other notices, and we have a number of them today. From Cedar Rapids, Janeth Lewis, age 102, died Friday, November 25th. The Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home in Cedar Rapids is in charge of the arrangements. From Decorum, LaVon Bonnie Doherty, age 96, died Friday, November 25th. In charge of arrangements is the Helms Funeral Home of Decorum. Also from Decorum, Cynthia Avis Lance, age 73, died Wednesday, November 23rd. The Burnham Wood Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service of West Union will assist the family. From Fort Atkinson, Serenus Ellsburned, age 95, died Friday, November 25th. Assisting the family will be the Helms Funeral Home of Decorum. From Maynard, Mary M. Idle, age 66, died Wednesday, November 23rd. The Jameson Schmitz Funeral Home of Maynard will be in charge of the arrangements. From Newhall, Wolfred J. Becker, age 93, died Sunday, November 27th. In charge of the arrangements will be the Phillips Funeral Home of Vinton. From North Liberty, Dan E. Christensen, age 67, died Friday, November 25th. In charge of the arrangements is the Henderson Barker Funeral Home of West Liberty. From Olmine, Virginia A. Rohde, 91, died Friday, November 25th. The Jameson Schmitz Funeral Home in Olmine will assist the family. From Shellsburg, John Brody, age 58, died Saturday, November 26th. In charge of those arrangements will be the Phillips Funeral Home of Vinton. And from Vinton, Donald W. Smith, age 90, died Sunday, November 27th. Assisting the family will be the Phillips Funeral Home of Vinton. Now for the longer, more detailed funeral notices. Of Cedar Rapids, Doris May Curlmeyer passed away peacefully November 25th. Her funeral service will be held at 11 o'clock the morning of November 29th at St. Paul's United Methodist Church in the chapel. A luncheon may will follow. Memorials may be directed to St. Paul's United Methodist Church or the PEO Sisterhood in care of the family. Bruce William Richards, age 70, of Cedar Rapids, passed away Wednesday, November 23rd at his home. Funeral services will be held at 11 o'clock Saturday morning, December 3rd, at the Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home. Visitation will be at 10 o'clock at the funeral home. Byron Russell Moorhead, age 98 of Cedar Rapids, died Friday, November 25th at the Villages of Marion. Services will be at 11 o'clock Tuesday morning, November 29th at Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories, where a visitation will begin at 10 a.m. until service time. Burial will be in the Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery with full military honors. Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home is in charge of the arrangements. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to the Village Ridge at 365 Marion Boulevard in Marion. Randy William Mogensen, age 58 of Marion, passed away on Wednesday, November 23rd, after a courageous journey with cancer. He fought endlessly to give us as much time with him as possible and is now at peace with his eldest daughter, Lane, again. The family invites family and friends to attend the memorial service on Thursday, December 1st at Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories at 4200 First Avenue Northeast in Cedar Rapids. The visitation will begin at 3 p.m. at the Cedar Memorial Chapel stateroom, and the funeral will follow at 5 o'clock in the chapel. Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home is in charge of the arrangements. Marjorie E. Novak Stanton, age 73 of rural Tiffin, died suddenly Friday, November 25th, at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Funeral services will be held at 6:30 p.m. Wednesday, November 30th, at Gay and Chia Funeral and Cremation Service in Iowa City, where there will be a time of visitation for family and friends from 3 p.m. Wednesday until service time at the funeral home. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations can be shared with Grace United Methodist Church of Tiffin, Tiffin First Responders, or Oxford First Responders. Charlie Marie Engelken, age 13, of Manchester, passed away on Wednesday, November 23rd at the Regional Medical Center in Manchester. Visitation will be from 2 to 7 p.m. Wednesday, November 30th at St. Mark Catholic Church in Edgewood with a prayer service at 7 o'clock. A Mass of Christian burial will be at 10:30 a.m. Thursday at St. Mark Catholic Church with the Reverend John Haugen presiding. Interment will be at the Sand Creek Cemetery in rural Manchester. Randy Jean Hartle of Hiawatha passed away on Sunday, November 20th at the age of 70. Christopher Mark Steffen died of pancreatic cancer at age 76. A rosary will be at 4:30 p.m. Thursday, December 1st at Lensing Funeral and Cremation Service in Iowa City. Visitation will follow from 5 to 7. Mass of Christian burial will be held at 10:30 Friday morning, December 2nd at the Newman Center in Iowa City. Interment will immediately follow at St. Joseph's Cemetery. Memorials may be made to the Newman Center or to the Iowa City Public Library Friends Foundation. Vonda Lee Anderson, age 90 of Delhi, passed away peacefully in her winter home in Florida on Tuesday, November 22nd. A memorial service will be held at a later date, with burial at the Center Point Cemetery. David Allen Sovers, formerly of Iowa City, passed away Monday, October 3rd, in Maricopa, Arizona, at the age of 79. Memorial services will be held at 10 a.m. Saturday, March 4th, at the mausoleum located at Memory Garden Cemetery in Iowa City. Military honors will be provided, honoring his service to his country. Voanne Jean Miller Hansen, age 97 of Marion, passed away on Friday, November 25th at Winslow House Care Center in Marion. A private family graveside services will be held at Oak Shade Cemetery in Marion. The Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Marion is assisting the family. Instead of flowers, memorials in Voanne's memory may be made to either the Marion School Foundation or the Marion Public Library Foundation. David Lumiere Pisley, age 74 of Atkins, formerly of Cedar Rapids, passed away on Tuesday, November 22nd in Mesa, Arizona. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, December 2nd at the Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids. The funeral will be held at 10:30 Saturday morning, December 3rd at Good News Baptist Church in Cedar Rapids with Dr. Dave T. Smith presiding. Burial will follow at St. John's Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. There will be a reception at the church following burial. And finally, Judith Ann Smith, age 81, died peacefully at her home on Wednesday, November 23rd. A memorial service will be held at 11 o'clock Thursday morning at the Lensing Funeral and Cremation Service of Iowa City, with Father Ed Fitzpatrick officiating. Visitation will be from 10 to 11 a.m. before the service. A luncheon will follow at the Kirkwood Room. A private family burial will be at St. Joseph Cemetery. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to the West Branch Fire Department or to St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital. Turning now to the sports page, we have a boys basketball preview written by Jeff Johnson of the Gazette. It's just entitled Great Expectations. It seems like Kenzie Reed has been around Cedar Rapids Kennedy basketball forever. 4 years on varsity is unusual, especially at the Class 4A level. You've watched the kid grow on the court, improve his shooting, use his ball skills, quickness, and vision to become one of the better true point guards around. You've noticed how he's grown up, period, no longer uncomfortable in interviews and eager to chat you up. Reed said flatly, "We expect to get back to the state tournament." He was asked the other day about his team's experience and expectations for this year. He said, "We want to win the championship. That's what all the guys' goals are. That's what we've been working for since basketball season ended last year, so that's what we want." How realistic does he feel that is? He said without hesitation, "It's a clear sight. I can see it happening. Me and that guy over there, we're going to do big things this year. We're about to be the best backcourt Kennedy has ever seen. I'm telling you that." The guy Reed was pointing to was teammate and classmate Colby Dolphin. The excitement surrounding these Cougars begins with those two guys. "Definitely, they are among the best guard tandems in the state. Reed is a returning first-team All-Stater in 4A. Dolphin is a returning second-teamer. They play off each other expertly." Kennedy coach John McCowan said, "They are on the same page, which is always a good start. And they complement each other. Kenzie can get to the rim as good as anybody," he said, "and Colby can space the floor. So their strengths are different, but they need each other to be as successful as they are." Dolphin averaged a team-best 14 points per game and shot 40% from three-point range as Kennedy went 21-4 and qualified for the state tournament last year, losing to champion Ames in the semifinals. Reed averaged 12.9 points, 6.7 assists, and shot 40% as well from beyond the arc. "They're not big," Dolphin checking in at 6 foot and Reed at 5'10", "but that's the only potential knock here." Dolphin said, "Kenzie is just a natural point guard. He's a great leader, knows how to distribute the ball, knows how to score. He can really break a guy down one-on-one. It's just easier to work off a guy who can do all that." Reed said, "We've just got great chemistry together. He's the ideal off-guard you can ask for. He doesn't miss open shots. He can play defense. He's consistent. Nothing but praise for him." There are others around that make the return to state, make a deep run at state talk, not hyperbole. Junior Cyrus Courtney is an athletic wing and an integral piece, as is senior guard Carter Newhouse, who adds another guy who can shoot the three ball. Kennedy's sophomore team lost just once last season, so you know there is potential help there. Watch for the coach's son Trey to play a lot at guard. Coach McCowan said after Wednesday afternoon scrimmages against Cedar Rapids Xavier and Iowa City West, "They spent all off-season working hard. They were in here before school, after school. They were wearing out the shooting gun, and they were in here together. I've had kids who come in by themselves, but this group, it's been just like this. They just played for 2.5 hours, and a bunch of them are still here." You definitely have pressure after what we did last year, according to Dolphin, but you want to have those expectations if you're a good team. You want the mark set high for you. By the way, Reed made his college decision, verbally committing to Division II Upper Iowa. The Peacocks up there are coached by Brooks McCowan, John's brother. Reed said he contemplated waiting to see if there would be any D1 offers come his way, but decided being close to home was important, as was being able to eat regularly at the Servery, the first Mongolian grill on a college campus. "I'm already familiar with the McCowan family," he said. "I know a lot of guys up at that school. It's pretty close for my family to go up there and watch me, but what really got me is they've got like a hoo-hot-like grill in the cafeteria. It's great. I'm going to live in there." Moving on to the community page, a story written by Vanessa Miller of the Gazette, Iowa City Project seeks donations for toy redistribution. Dateline, Iowa City. Stemming from one local child's COVID-era fear that Christmas would be canceled, Iowa City area nonprofits in fall 2020 launched a toy redistribution initiative that they're reviving this year, even as pandemic-related fears have waned a bit. Iowa City Toy Redistribution Project manager or organizer said, "We recognize that while the world might feel a little more normal, families are still struggling. We are bringing back the IC Toy Redistribution Project as a means to provide redistributed free toys to whoever can use them." The project, which is a collaboration of Corridor Community Action Network, the LENA Project, Iowa City-based social justice advocate Ann Ventulo and others, with financial backing from Velvet Lotus Tattoo, will look a bit different this year. In 2020, due to the state of the pandemic during the initiative's first go, participating families browsed toys pictured online, and organizers made individual pickup arrangements. The project this year will announce redistribution locations, sites, times, and dates that haven't yet been unveiled. Organizers remain in toy collection mode, hoping to serve as many as possible. According to the website, which concedes all toys are free, there are no requirements for participating and no questions asked. Depending on availability, we may need to limit the number of toys per family. To that end, organizers are urging donations of quality used toys, committing to do that, at least some of the work, to prepare them to be gifted. According to the redistribution site, assess if the toy is something you would have been excited to unwrap yourself as a child. If the toy is in bad shape, skip it. If it is a high-quality toy, we are excited to redistribute it. Some toys may need a bit of TLC. If a toy is nearly in good condition but needs a bit of a washdown, please do this at home before donating. The team has set up an online donation process, asking community members to use a form describing what they plan to give and when. Although the idea emerged from concerns around families struggling financially, the project aims to curb consumerism and help the environment. According to a news release, they aim to reimagine holiday shopping, providing affordable, free toy gifts while reducing consumerism and waste. And the drive is taking financial gifts as well to keep the project going in subsequent years. According to project officials, additionally, the group would like to balance out toy redistribution by including holiday meal support and gifts for teens and adults when needed. They went on to say, so gift cards to grocery stores, Walmart, Target, shoe stores, app points, malls, movie theaters, art supplies stores, etc. are greatly appreciated as well. There are some Eastern Iowa briefs we need to take a look at today. First one comes from Cedar Rapids. Coe College will host Christmas worship events at 11 o'clock Tuesday morning in Sinclair Auditorium at 1220 First Avenue Northeast in Cedar Rapids. The Christmas convocation of lessons and carols will feature the Coe College Handbell Ringers, the Concert Choir, the Crimson Singers, Brett Wolgast on the organ, and Marita Wolgast leading the bell choir. Students will assist with the readings. Also, Coe will host Christmas Jazz Vespers at 7 o'clock Tuesday night in Sinclair Auditorium. It will include the Coe Jazz Band, as well as students reading poems, scripture readings, and prayers. Also from Cedar Rapids, the Cedar Rapids Public Library is joining with ARP Iowa to hold a gingerbread house contest. Starting Thursday, gingerbread kits will be available for pickup at both library locations, downtown at 450 Fifth Avenue Southeast and the Ladd Library at 3750 Williams Boulevard Southwest, as well as the Northwest Recreation Center at 1340 11th Street Northwest while supplies last. Kits will include everything needed to build an adorable gingerbread home and mini gingerbread house for a special addition to the main home. Use your creativity to build the homes, adding the mini house either as an attached or detached addition to the main house. For ARP, the contest highlights accessory dwelling units, fully self-contained homes on the same lot as the main house. They are commonly called granny flats or backyard bungalows and can be a source of affordable housing. Snap a photo and enter the contest by December 12th for a chance to win prizes. There is a limit of one entry per person or family or team. Entries must include an ADU to be considered for a prize. By entering your photo in the contest, you give the Cedar Rapids Public Library permission to share it online and in print. The winning gingerbread houses will be shown from a series of categories. From Iowa City, over the holiday season, Communities Food Bank will provide nearly 1,500 local families with all the ingredients needed to make a traditional holiday dinner. For the first time in the project's 35-year history, prior registration will not be required to receive a meal. Crystal Cabela, Communities Food Bank manager, said in a news release, "The hope is that eliminating registration will increase the accessibility of Project Holiday and provide meals for more local families. Due to rising food costs, we saw a 36% increase in people receiving food this quarter compared to the same time frame last year. With an increase in demand for groceries and lower barriers to receive a meal, staff expects to distribute more Project Holiday meals than ever before." Julia Winter, the Director of Development, said in the news release, "Support from the community is more important than ever this year. Many of our neighbors must make difficult budget decisions every day. Your gift of $30 can not only take away that burden, but also provide a beautiful opportunity for families to gather and celebrate the season." Meal distribution will take place during the regular hours from December 12th through 17th at Communities Food Pantry at Pepperwood Plaza at 1045 Highway 6 East. Meals can be ordered for delivery for those who are unable to travel. We do have a few under the column of things to do today. For example, there is a fundraiser and benefit HACAP food drive. Bring non-perishable food items and food for a HACAP food reservoir. Some of the most requested items include whole wheat pasta, brown rice, canned fruit and juice, nuts and seeds. It's all day until 8 p.m. tonight at the Hiawatha Public Library at 150 West Wilman Street in Hiawatha. The cost? There is a free will offering. Under educational, Girls in STEM take-home kit, lava lamps. Girls in 4th through 8th grade can pick up their lava lamp kit. Participants will explore chemical reactions by making their own lava lamp. It's going to happen today until 7 p.m. at the Ely Public Library at 1595 Dow Street in Ely, and the cost is free. Under holiday, holiday lights at the lake. Drive or walk through this mile-long path of large animated holiday lights. It's going to happen from 5:30 to 8:30 tonight at the West Overlook Campground in West Overlook Road in Iowa City. Under Museum Exhibit, the Hoover Museum Exhibit on Russian Famine of 1921 through 23. This new temporary exhibit tells the story of one of the great humanitarian efforts in history, Herbert Hoover and the American Relief Administration's food and medical relief efforts during the Soviet famine of 1921 through 1922. It's going on until 5 o'clock this afternoon at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch. Also under museum, Magic and Mystery, Mardi Gras and Carnival Traditions. Now this exhibit will feature Czech and Slovak carnival masks and costumes next to ornate beaded parade costumes from the American South, along with Czech beaded necklaces. It goes on until 4 o'clock this afternoon at the National Czech and Slovak Museum and Library at 1400 Inspiration Place Southwest in Cedar Rapids. The cost is free and up to $10. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Monday, November 28th. I'm your reader, Kelly Neff. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thank you for listening.